Welcome back to this weekly meeting of the Health and Safety Committee with Denver City Council. Coverage of the Health and Safety Committee starts now.
Good morning and welcome to the Health and Safety Committee. My name is Daryl Watson. I'm honored to serve as the chair of this committee and also as the representative representing Defying District 9 on Denver City Council. We have one briefing today from our from Director Colette Vett from the Chief Municipal Public Defender's Office. And before we go into the briefing, why don't we have introductions around the table? And actually, let me check first. Do we have council members online? So Councilmember Sawyer, are you online? We'll start with you.
Hey, everyone. Excuse me. Hey, everyone. Thanks, Chair Watson, Amanda Sawyer, Denver City Council, District 5.
Good to see you. Why don't we start on my right, and we just go around the table for council member introductions.
Kevin Flynn, Southwest Denver's District 2.
Hi, everyone. Serena Gonzalez-Gutierrez, one of your council members at large.
Good morning. Paul Cashman, South Denver District 6.
Sarah Parody, the other council member at large.
Jamie Torres, West Denver District 3.
Well, with that, I'll turn it over, Colette, to you and your team to introduce yourself and introduce your team, and thank you all so much for being here.
Great. Thank you so much. Thank you, Councilman Watson. It's a pleasure to be here and tell you all a little bit more about our office and the work that we do. To my left is Ari Kritchever, who's our Deputy Public Defender, Colin March, who is our lead new youth attorney, Rachel Mercer, who is our appellate and legislative aide, an update attorney, senior attorney, and Ty Cope, who's our supervisor for our client support team. You'll hear about all of these things during the course of our presentation today. So I think we're ready to go. I don't know how to connect this.
So
it's in front of me.
It'll come up in a
minute. Okay.
Is it coming up?
Oh yeah, there we go.
There it is.
Thank you. And I'm really, you'll be seeing people from our office that are gonna be floating in, and I'm just really so proud of the work that everyone is doing here, and hopefully you'll hear more about why we are so proud of the work that we're doing with the Office of the Municipal Public Defender.
And Colette, I'll say, since you have such a great group of folks from the office, would you mind introducing them, even though they're sitting in the audience?
I would be delighted to introduce them. Jacob, who is our bilingual case manager, that's with the client support team. Lulu, who is with our legal secretary and aide with our youth department. We have Tyler, who is an attorney in courtroom 4B. We have Rainbow, who is another peer navigator, peer specialist with our office. Hannah, who's our behavioral health navigator with our client support team. Eleanor, who is an attorney in courtroom 4C. Eric Galtz, who's attorney in 4B. And we've got Candace, who is a veteran and with our client support team as a peer specialist.
All right. Well, thanks for stacking the room.
One of the things that we really are proud of is that we are a holistic public defender's office that works to work collaboratively together. We are unique in the terms that we have phenomenal lawyers that you'll hear about, but with our lawyers and our client support team and our every single day working with our clients, we seek to get them connected to services, to have them represented by some of the finest lawyers, to hear their stories, to tell our clients' stories, and to restore respect and dignity for our clients. And so that's really one of our proudest missions that we do at OMPD. In order to qualify for OMPD, our clients live below the federal poverty line. 80% of our clients live with trauma. Many of them are dealing with substance misuse, behavioral health issues, mental health issues, a brain injury. It was when I first came here when I was working with the Brain Injury Alliance, understanding that upwards of 80 to 90% of our clients have traumatic brain injury. And so we have clients that are really one of the most vulnerable citizens or residents of Denver, I should say. The majority of our clients are unhoused or experiencing housing instability, and many have limited access to health care, especially for our Black, Hispanic, and people of color. That has become really more significantly underscored in the recent months with so many of our dear partners being fired and leaving and many of the organizations closing up, it has had a very intense, significant impact on our clients. People experiencing homelessness are 11 times more likely to be arrested than housed individuals. And in Denver, nearly 40% of our municipal court cases involve people that are experiencing homelessness for low-level offenses, trespass, open container, camping violations, disturbing the peace. As a holistic model, we are in four adult courtrooms during the week, 4A, B, C, and E, and we are on the fourth floor of the Lindsay Flanagan Courthouse. I always encourage City Council, if you ever want to watch and see what goes on in municipal court, please come by. And if you want to contact us and say, can we be there for a docket or a trial date, I would love for you to come watch, because so much goes on in that courtroom, and you will see who we represent and the quality of our representation. Our youth court that Colin is now leading is on Thursdays at 2 p.m. in courtroom 2B, or 1 p.m. in courtroom 2B. Our office is open 5 days a week for people to drop in, to apply for our office, and to just have a place that they can sit and talk. I'll share more about that. We bring court to the people twice a month. We are an outreach court twice a month, and quarterly we do fresh start warrant clearing events. We have first appearance court. We are in court 7 days a week. So this is our model. In every courtroom, we have four lawyers, a lead lawyer and three lawyers, a client support team member, a peer specialist, a paralegal, and a legal secretary. And we started to do this collaboratively about a year and a half ago. And what it's doing is that this office has become so much more gelled, and we love each other, and we're friendly, and we work together, because what's going on with the client support team is shared with the lawyers. What the lawyers are doing is shared with the legal secretaries, the paralegals, and everyone knows about every client, which makes it very unique. 21 lawyers. And sometimes you hear the expression, you start out at the public defender's office and then you become a real lawyer and you go into private practice. That is not what public defenders do. The lawyers that work in our office are some of the finest lawyers that I've ever worked with in the country. Many of them from private practice, many of them from the state public defender's office, where they did high-level appeals like Rachel, robberies, murders, and very high-level cases. They take those skills and they bring them into municipal court. And the beauty of municipal court is that the judges allow them to try the cases as if they were trying serious felonies. From jury selection to closing argument, you come in and you watch a trial, you will be blown away. And it's for cases like disturbing the peace, trespass, park violations, shoplifting, low-level domestic violence, assault cases, off-leash, dog bite, dog cases. We have many of those, by the way. Those should not be criminal. We were hoping that maybe we could talk to City Council about making those civil infractions, because it's kind of crazy about how the ordinance is written to be continued. Okay. And we represent thousands of people on traffic cases. And Councilman Cashman, we do think there may be some profiling happening now that you were interested in a couple of years ago. So I will hook you up with Lindsay Vitalis, who runs our trafficking department. We are in court 7 days a week, so every Saturday, every Sunday, and holiday dockets, we are in court. As I said, we are a holistic, client-centered, community-oriented approach to criminal defense. We are in the community every single day. People know who we are, our client support team, our lawyers. We meet with people. We go to organizations to explain what our processes are. If people have warrants, how do we clear them? We want to make it as accessible as possible. Our client support team, and Ty is our supervisor. Leanne Ficus, who is the social worker that runs client support team, is currently in Europe right now, traveling. But we're really proud of this team, because we have Ty as the supervisor, Hannah's our behavior health navigator, Jacob is our bilingual case manager, and our peer specialists, and Rainbow's here, Candace is here. We have Dan, and who am I missing?
Kirsten.
Thank you. Kirsten. And Kirsten is our youth peer specialist. So we, every time when we go into court for youth, we have the same teams that are going together there. Our client support team, we give wraparound in-demand peer support, case management, behavioral health navigation. We help connect our clients to community resources, services, behavioral health treatments. We support all of the courtrooms, and we work with the community and the city partners to have see how we are working. It's getting cold. So Leanne and our in our office have been coordinating for how do we get housing and what are options are available. So we call all of the people together that are involved in the coalition and other organizations to sit down and try to brainstorm. DHS, there's so many that come together, and our office, what can we do as it gets cold? And so we really want to do this working together. I put this up here. I'm not going to go through this, but since January of 2025 through September 31st, these are the services that we have worked with our clients: jail and reentry services, homeless and basic needs for our daily living, employment, vocational, behavioral health, case management, and youth and emerging youth adults. We meet with these organizations on a very regular basis. We've really become community partners. People call our offices if they say, you know, can you help us? We met with the coalition last week, and they have clients that have open warrants. Please contact our office, and we will walk them through the system. We have a grant with Stride, which has been working really beautifully to have some of our clients get housing. We work very closely with the jail and the sheriff's office to see if we can work and take advantage of some of the programming that is available for our clients that are coming out of custody. Really proud of the work that we're doing. And as a result of this work and keeping people out of custody, we save money, and it's a price savings. So jail beds, approximately $164 a night. We don't have the exact number, but approximately, probably closer to 200. We know from, there's so much research about that low-level offenders who spend time in jail 24, 48 hours are more likely to recidivate. So when you hear this kind of, I would call it almost a false narrative of people saying, wouldn't it be better, Colette, if your clients who are repeat shoplifters or trespassing got sentences like 90 days? Because then they could take advantage of all the great programs at the jail. And that is just not available. The staffing at the jail is so limited. The programming at the jail has been cut so dramatically. They are working desperately to help the clients that are there, but it's impossible. So that, you know, for us, it is a better cost saving. It's very safe for the community for them to be out. We connect them with services. Our client support team goes into the jail and they help on reentry programs, so that when you get out, there's a plan for where you can go. There's been some little road stops in the way, which I'll talk about, but you know, right now we know that there's limited addiction and mental health programming at DDC and at the other, you know, but we can, if they're out, connect them with those services. We work with housing. We work with transportation. We were fortunate enough to get a grant for bus vouchers, which is like, I can't, how do we describe it? It's like such a great gift. I mean, people come to our office and we are able to give them bus vouchers so they can get to court, they can get to shelters, they can get around the city. It's been very, very helpful. We do help with all of those things, including clothing and food. Our office, we collect money on a monthly basis, and someone will go to Costco and fill up our refrigerator and our freezer with food so that when clients come to our office, and if they haven't eaten for 24, 48 hours, which is something we see every day, they have food. They have a glass of water. They've got soda, whatever it is. We have clothing. We have lots of clothing for our clients. We've got mittens. We've got warm heaters. We've got jackets. So we really try to make it so when you come to our office, can we get something? They oftentimes leave with a bag, and they have their food, and they're sated. Our lawyers work so closely with trying to get great results. Cases are being dismissed because of either rape mitigation and negotiation or discovery violations. Cases are being won, not guilties, because of the quality of the investigation and knowing what the cases are about. We go into the courtroom, we walk in, and we are the people that the jury is looking at for who is going to be the soothsayer in that courtroom. We are resolving our cases expediently, and we're working to get the best results for our clients. I'm very proud of the work that we're doing in youth court. You met Colin, Lulu, and Kirsten is our peer support specialist. They're in court every Thursday. And they're working really to stop or the school-to-prison pipeline. I want to thank, again, Councilman Cashman and Councilwoman Gonzalez-Gutierrez for working with us to get our ordinance changed in 2024. And it was such a wonderful series of stakeholder meetings. Everyone thought it would be great for OMPD to be in court. And they said, could you be there yesterday? And so we are there. We are representing hundreds of kids. We know we're keeping intense data. So I want to thank Colin and Lulu, especially for giving us the keeping track of the data. Who's being ticketed? And so we know that Black youth adults are 11 times more likely to be arrested by the age of 20. And we know that if they have any initial encounter, young teens, that they're more likely to be more involved in the criminal legal system. We represent children who are 10 years old. We represent children who can't even see over the podium. And so we want to make sure that children who are acting like children and making a mistake like children are treated with dignity and respect. So we support these children. We are connecting our kids and their families with, you know, anything that they need, either treatment providers or daily living help. We want to ensure that the kids know that we are working for them. Colin meets with the client and their families. I hate to say the word client, but their kids and their families. And so they're investigating more cases. We see a lot of bullying cases, and that's something that, you know, what happens oftentimes is DPS might just throw the net out and we'll take everyone in and everyone gets a ticket, including our client, who may be the kid that's getting bullied. So it's up to us. If they didn't have lawyers there, then we wouldn't have the right to challenge some of these things. I'm going to talk about last year briefly, but we got around from July of 24 till December 31st, that's when we started representing, we had about 320 cases. 40 cases were brought against Black youth, 20% against Black girls, 20% against Black boys, or roughly 32% of the charges against Hispanic youth, and 43% of the cases were came through. And now it's even higher that are getting diversion. And many of the majority of the cases are assaults and public fighting that come out of the schools. We keep the data from every school, and we've shared this, I know, with Councilwoman Gonzalez-Gutierrez and Cashman, Councilman Cashman. You know, we know that which schools are giving more tickets. We know that they could have the alternatives to citation, which we're really trying to meet with stakeholders. They've kind of revised diversion. So we're really trying to work together with all of the parties to say, get these children as the littlest touch with the system that we can do. In 2025, we've represented about 395 kids, so it's higher than last year at this time of the year. And the stats about who the Black youth that we're representing, and Black young girls are more ticketed than anyone. And it's disproportionately ticketing young Black girls. And we know about the adultification of Black girls. So when they come into the system, we treat them as with respect and as the children, and work with both the girls and the boys that are coming through. We're working with DPS. We are working with other youth organizations, Transformative Youth, Justice Project. We're working fully liberated youth. Colin has met with a lot of other alternate programs, such as Mira Image Arts. I always forget the other ones. It's Arts Ashes.
Yeah.
Arts to Ashes. Spoken word is
Soul Stories.
These are like, if kids are interested in art or music or writing, or they want to box and, you know, get out there. We are trying to connect. And Colin and Lulu and Kirsten meet with the children and say, what are you interested in? So even then, we could talk to Diversion and say, they would be a perfect fit for Mirror Image Arts or Soul Story. Soul Stories. And so we've been really, that's been a real joy to see our kids flourish and to be successful. The collaboration and, you know, when Diversion really took a hit in August with losing people, they regrouped and they had a beautiful open house about, how many weeks ago was that? Just a couple weeks ago. And the people that they have, their staffing at Diversion is really people that have been working with Big Brothers, have been school teachers, middle school teachers, principals, working within the probation and in other youth spaces. They know how to work with youth. So we're excited about that. And we are excited that children know that there is a constitution and they have the right to exercise their right to trial. So we are standing next to them. So I'm really proud of the work that youth is doing. We are out in the communities all the time. These are some pictures from Future Fest. We were at the Pride Parade. As I said before, we are an outreach court twice a month. We're at the Denver Public Library on the second Wednesday and Denver Human Services on the East Campus. Ari is the person that runs outreach court for our office. Can you give us a brief description to like what that's like?
Yeah, I mean, the point of outreach court is to bring court to folks that struggle with transportation, with housing, who may not be able to access the court through the sort of traditional system. So we're taking court out into the community, and we're combining it with connections to resources. So when someone comes to outreach court, and we're really catering to sort of the most low-level offenses, the park violations, the trespass, the shoplifting. When you come into outreach court, you are in a room full of service providers, folks from WellPower, from DHS, from Brain Injury Alliance of Colorado, and you come and you make a service connection, obtain some resources that are going to benefit you in your life, and in exchange, you're looking at a much more favorable resolution of your case, hopefully dismissal of your case, in an effort to get people out of the system and get moving in a good direction in their life.
It's been really wonderful. It's very uplifting when you go to outreach court, even if you don't. Sometimes we have people that don't qualify. They have cases that are not municipal, but they connect with services, they connect with our lawyers, and they leave feeling better than when they walked in.
And I would say if you're ever interested in attending, like Colette said, second and fourth Wednesday of every month, we're at one of those locations, and we're always happy to have people come and check it out.
The public library space is spectacular. We were there yesterday again. It's just so beautiful. So just shout out. Fresh Start is it's twice a year. So it's a warrant clearing event and it's very, very well attended. And we had about 100, I can't remember, 30 people that came through from with municipal court cases. You get cases dismissed, you get good resolutions. It's just a really lovely event. They were processed through the AIDS Center, and we used to hold outreach there, but that's another discussion, which I will bring up shortly. Wellness in the Park, you know, DPD sponsors Wellness in the Park. This is our, you know, you could see our, this is our office right here. And this is, Alex is one of our senior lawyers. That was his office. And so we have the judge that, you know, that's there, and we try to negotiate our pleas, and they do Wellness in the Park. It's pretty awesome. Our office, we proactively sought out OSEI, and we wanted to do some more work internally about ensuring that we call ourselves the JEDI, justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion. And can we be better serving ourselves internally as we're doing this work externally? We contacted OSEI, and we became one of three that are in a pilot project for doing racial equity action plan. 95% of our staff participated in the action plan. We have a roadmap that has been created by OSEI. We just did a needs assessment by OSEI. They're coming, they met with leadership. They're coming to meet with our entire office on October 27th. And then we're going to continue on a monthly basis doing presentations, workshops, so that we are doing the racial equity work that's really powerful and supported by the city. Now I talk about some of the challenges that we have been facing at OMPD. As many of you probably realize, when we opened our borders and we had many of Venezuelans coming in looking for temporary status and work permits, we have seen in the last year a 300% increase in immigration advisements. It's been probably one of the most difficult areas that we have been dealing with. Eleanor's came to our office after doing immigration work. And what did you say yesterday? It was that to me about the advice. What are the complexity of this?
She's to come.
And
to
Eleanor,
the mic.
If you would like to come to the mic, just right there. And if you don't mind,
said something not very hopeful.
If you don't. Yeah, and introduce yourself as well.
Hi, my name's Eleanor Hardy. I'm a lawyer at the Office of the Municipal Public Defender. Before I came to OMPD, I used to work for the Meyer Law Office, and then before that, I was an immigration fellow with the Southern Poverty Law Center. And so part of what we do is that there are certain pleas that carry immigration consequences. So if a certain person, if I were to plead guilty to municipal assault, that has no consequences for me. But for example, that used to, 2 or 3 years ago, that was an immigration safe plea. There now has been a change in the immigration law that says that that is now a crime involving moral turpitude, which means that you are automatically ineligible for certain immigration benefits. I have been out of immigration for a long time. It is a fast moving administrative law based area of the law. And so what we do with immigration advisements is that we pay an outside lawyer, an immigration specialist, when these issues are changing to say, hey, I have a new client. The offer is to plead guilty to assault. Is that safe for this person who is, you know, 25 years old and from Venezuela and has a 3-year-old citizen child? All of these sort of fact-based nuances. And that's the reason that we have to do the immigration advisements. I hope that's the answer to
that. Yeah, that's right. Thank you, Eleanor. And the difficulty that we're all facing every day is that the law is ever changing. Is there any advice that we can give our clients that will protect them? The Lake and Riley executive order came down last year that now shoplifting, $5. Can get you deported. You know, we've seen what's been going on in other jurisdictions with, you know, the ICE, everyone coming in Portland, Washington State, Chicago. It's devastating, and we're so scared that it's going to happen in Denver. And the grief that we have suffered in the last few months, losing clients to ICE and not knowing what's going to happen, where are they? The grief when someone was going to show up in court and they failed to appear and we can't get in touch with them, we don't know where they are. It's been a real thing for our office. The loss of the AIDS Center was really very, very difficult for our office. Our clients use the AIDS Center every day for treatment providers to help get their ID, to speak with the coalition, to speak with tribe. There was a counselor that was on staff that was there that could talk to the clients that come out of jail and were itching to use again, and they would get them, speak with them, and try to get them hooked up with services. When I was there 2 days before it closed the first time, there was a dentist there that was doing medical work, you know, and was treating our clients. There was hygiene products there. Every time, before they go to court, if they were unhoused, there was lockers there. They can put their clothing there, their livelihood, their family, which is their pets. There was kennels there. So they would put everything at the AIDS Center, then walk over to the courthouse for their court case. And my fear, as I shared with the mayor, is that the clients will FTA because there's no place to put this stuff. And that's what's happening. So that's been a real challenge. The location was great. People coming out of jail could just walk over there. The community support and trust that Carlon and Celeste made, it was just a really wonderful, supportive place. Since the AIDS Center closed, our office, I don't want to get emotional, really became like a second, like the bridge. And it became so overwhelming that we had people in our office clogging the lobby every day, looking for food, looking for shelter, looking for help, looking for vouchers. I walked in a couple weeks ago when they had that terrible rainstorm, and it was like people sleeping, and you know, some person was just like covered in food, and someone was having, you know, a crisis, and it got to the point where our staff had to spend so much time in the front lobby trying to care for people that we don't have the capacity for. And nor do we have the capabilities for doing it. So we had to make the very difficult decision to, you know, put our hours of office hours down from 8:30 to 12:30, and so that we could have some semblance of having, you know, going back to doing the work that public defenders are supposed to do. So that's been a real challenge for us. On a brighter note, I could say that Rachel, who was from the State Public Defender's Appellate Unit, is a senior lawyer at our office, is going to concentrate on doing appellate work, but also working with ordinance changes and legislation, was very active in the 1147, a parity legislation last year. So we really want to be as active as we possibly can to work with City Council to help make the ordinance and how we proceed during our daily life in a very thoughtful, powerful way. So thank you for the work that you've been doing too, Rachel. Some challenges, more so challenges. I thought I had it up here, but August 11th, we started getting hit with motions from the city attorney's office questioning our applications, questioning the veracity of poverty, of indigency. We have a form that we fill out, which is from the Supreme Court directive. We have to calculate whether or not they can qualify for the public defender's office, whether they meet the federal poverty guidelines. They have to do this calculation. But what many of our clients are what we call zeros. They have no income. They've got no assets and they have no expenses because they're unhoused, or they get the money from a couple of family members to grab a sandwich, or they're couch surfing, but they don't have any assets. So we have been in the courts in the last 2 months litigating poverty, and it has taken hours and hours and hours away from the work that we did. I want to share with you all, poverty exists in Denver. And as I offered for you to come to our courthouse, come to our office. I think the first picture that started this out, I went to take a picture of the outside of our office, which is beautiful, by the way, the inside. But there was a gentleman that was sleeping on the bench in front of our office. That happens every day. There are people that will scrounge through the garbage can if their office is not open yet, and they will come in. So poverty exists, and that's been a real challenge for us to have to really go into court and to defend our clients and to talk about their circumstances in an open courtroom, which seems really like a colossal waste of really good resources and the time of our lawyers. When I meet with community organizations, I always say we are a public safety organization. We want to serve our community. When we see clients, if they get a not guilty or they get a great result, we oftentimes shake their hands and say, no offense, but I hope we never see you again. And we hope we never see them again because now they've been connected to services. I could tell you 1,000 really wonderful stories about how people have really changed their lives, even folks with 30 plus trespasses or more. We strive to connect our clients with services. We deliver client-centered justice. And our goal is and always will be the least touch on the criminal legal system. Because even though this is a municipal court with low level of offenses, it could be the birthplace of mass incarceration. Because once you touch the system as a young adult or as a youth, and that's usually where they first touch the system, that becomes part of their record and it starts to amass. So we want to change that and reverse that and make our clients feel fully served and restoring their dignity and respect. So I'm thankful for allowing you all to hear us today, and I'm really grateful to everyone at the Municipal Public Defender's Office for the work that they do every day. So thank you all.
Thank you so much, Colette. I should have started off with a dong-dong, Law and Order, Public Defender. Sorry. I so appreciate the intensity and the joy that you bring to this role. I think every meeting, briefing or discussion I have with you, we begin with a dialogue, and I am literally standing in where it's because of the love you have for this work and the passion you demonstrate. And I think it's obvious with the folks that I have engaged with your office. So thank you so much for what you bring and providing this information to the public so folks know the good work that you do and the challenges that you're facing. And some of those challenges, I think support from Denver City Council can provide some relief. And would love to engage a little deeper with you, Colette, on what you're facing with the city attorney's office. We'd love to have a sit down and kind of talk through how that process has begun and then see what support our teams can provide. I know, Councilmember Sawyer, you stated that you were out of the queue. Are you still out of the queue? And then I can go around the table for the existing queue. Thank you, Councilmember. And so our queue is Councilmembers Gonzalez Gutierrez, Councilmember Flynn, and then Councilmember Parity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, nobody got the Star Wars reference earlier.
I got the Star Wars reference.
I'm like, everybody's like this.
Straight still face. No react.
I'm like,
we got it, Jedi. Yeah.
I love that, by the way. Secondly, you're not amused, I can see. I feel so much judgment coming from across the table.
Yeah.
I might need your services. But thank you so much, though, for acknowledging when you're talking about our young people and referring to them as children. Mm-hmm. I really appreciate that fact and bringing light to the fact that kids as young as 10 years old can be charged and you know, they can be arrested, all of the things. And it's not just at municipal level, but it's at the delinquency state level mm-hmm. as well. I have a 10-year-old son, mm-hmm. So I get it. I wanted to ask if you all have heard about this program that we had a bunch of young people come to council a couple weeks ago, they were concerned about it. It's called GAIN. Mm-hmm. It's the Gun Violence Awareness Intervention Network. I was just curious if you all are familiar with this program that's out of being housed under the Office of Neighborhood Safety?
We're not, and we met last week to talk about it. There was something that happened in Aurora very similarly, which was incredibly disturbing. It was called the SAFE program in Aurora. And the letter that went out to the children that they were trying to target was really very scary. And not anything that would make you want to cooperate. And then, you know, we were trying to find out more information. We've met with some community organizations that were present or have heard about it. But on one of the slides that they showed, they said, well, OMPD yeah. is involved in this. And we were like, Colin, did you know anything? Yeah. We are not aware. We have not been invited to the table. I do not know what the letter is. I do not know what the program is. I do not know who it's targeting. I don't know if they're trying to like draw like a, you know, a letter on someone's back that is put like a G or something for gang. I don't know anything. We want to know anything. If city council finds out, please share, but know that we are not at the table and we don't know about the program.
Okay, thank you for that. I know a few of us have reached out to Dr. Sanders to try to get access more information. I think Mr. Chair is aware that many of us are asking a lot of questions about what this program is, but yes, that was the same information I received as well, and actually saw where it was on a whiteboard of a meeting that folks, community organizations attended, where it said that OMPD was part of this process. And so that's very concerning to find out that you are all in the dark about that particular program and especially what it involves.
It could impact trust in us.
Right.
And to have our name on that blackboard yeah. without knowing anything about the program was really concerning.
Yeah. And I'll just ask one more question, and I know some of my colleagues are in the queue. Can you talk to us a little bit about how diversion for youth has been revised? And because we've had presentations from Denver Public Safety Youth Programs who actually, does that work, has the diversion officers. And with that, what has been the coordination and collaboration with the city attorney's office, specifically in the youth court realm of things? So diversion, how has it changed? Because you mentioned it's been revised. I'm curious to hear that from y'all.
So when diversion presented to us, maybe a couple weeks ago, they came up with a bunch of different statistics to talk about how they are now making it more individualized to the youth. So they meet with the youth, they meet with the parent, and then they kind of do a conference between the diversion officer and the parent and the youth. So they all three. So the idea is it's supposed to be more individualistic. So they talk about goals, they talk about things that impact the kid that they're going through, that they would like assistance on. And so the program is supposed to be designed more around them. The diversion time has gone down. I think prior to diversion rechanging the program, it used to be around 125, 140 days. Now it's down to 93 days. Mm-hmm. So a youth is in diversion for about 3 months. That's the average amount of time. I can tell you all that, the community organizations I'm working with, I refer them a lot to diversion and try to make those connections so that diversion can work directly with those community organizations. So that's the information that they've provided to me and to us. And kind of how they've redone the program to make it really more focused on the youth instead of just, I think prior it was the community service and a course. Now it's more individualized to an interest that a kid has. So I know they're working with a lot of resume building for a lot of the 16, 17 year old clients. It's hard because they make it so unique. So the 10, 11, 12 year olds will get their own kind of individualized program. And those are usually very short. They are not in diversion for more than a month when I speak with the diversion officers themselves, because that's a big thing for me. And then, job building, career building for 16, 17 year olds, working to try to get them into college or some other kind of work program. So I think it's making progress. They just changed it about 2 months ago, so we're still kind of seeing the impact of those changes. And just continue to monitor all of that, what's going on.
That's great news. And I know that at some point there was, when we made that ordinance change, there was a lot of collaboration with the city attorney's office. Are you guys still seeing that level of collaboration? Is there any issues or bumps in the road, I guess?
So there are, I'm trying to think of the best way to say this. There are regular conversations with the city attorney's office. I meet with them regularly, and one of our normal topics is sort of what's happening in the youth court. Mm-hmm. In terms of what we've been able to do with diversion, just being honest, the city attorneys have not really been a part of that conversation. We, with sort of Collins' leadership, have connected with a lot of community organizations and have connected those places directly with diversion. So the diversion sort of has this, broad sort of variety of options to connect the youth with.
Great. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry.
Thank you. Councilwoman Gonzalez Gutierrez, one of the issues that we have, though, is that every week it's a different city attorney in the courtroom. So that's been a real difficult, because we hired Colin because he was an expert in youth representation. Now we're just having a cycling through of city attorneys who did not have youth experience. Every week it's someone different. So the ability to negotiate, the ability to mitigate, the ability to have discussions regarding competency, restitution, dismissals is significantly impacted.
And I will say the large percentage of city attorneys who are rotating through have no experience in youth court. They've never worked either at the state level in delinquency court or in the municipal level in youth court. So they are, it just depends. Like one week, the city attorneys are treating it like adult court. The next week, mm-hmm. maybe it's in between. The following week, it's maybe more youth focused. So I always bring this up because I know the judge and diversion and myself are all engaged together and we all work together. And the missing piece really is the city attorney. And it's frustrating that they don't take it as seriously as the other players in the courtroom.
Maybe they could follow the lead of our DA's office, which did institute a national juvenile division years ago. That was actually headed up by Courtney Johnston. I worked very closely with her on that. And so that was just made such a huge change, because instead of having new DAs cycling through juvenile court to get their feet wet, it became a dedicated division that people who wanted to work with youth and work in that court were actually assigned to work there and work there as long-term, not just a pass-through. So I think that it's great that we're bringing that to light, and maybe there's some opportunity to make some changes there. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Councilmember Gonzalez-Gutierrez, Councilmember Flynn, Parity, and Cashman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation, Colette. After we heard from the youth speakers at general public comment, I arranged for a deep dive on GAIN. And I hope that we bring them in here, because I got a completely different picture.
You already got
it. Because I proactively went out and got it. It's based on a very successful Operation Ceasefire that was developed in Boston in 1995. Mm-hmm. It's been nationally recognized. They're retooling the Denver program now because the results were not what they wanted. They had very few participants, but they don't go out and do a dragnet on kids. They invite individuals who have already been involved in gun crime, mm-hmm. either someone who has used a gun or someone who's been injured with a gun, someone who's been involved in a shooting, because statistics show that if you are a victim of gun violence, you are more likely to then use a gun later, and they're invited to participate. So they had 200 or so individuals that they reached out to, and they had only 9 or 10 who actually went through the program. The program involves identifying what are the causes. Are they unhoused? Are they food insecure? Can we see that you can get food, healthy food? Can we find housing? Can we find mental health resources? So it's a very positive intent. They only had, like I said, out of a pool of 200 who were invited or reached out to, very few ended up participating. But it had great results in Boston. It's been modeled in several dozen cities in the last 30 years. So I hope, Mr. Chair, we can have them come in and present here and get a view on what this is actually all about. It significantly reduced gun violence in Boston in the 90s. One question, and very quick, and it's personal perhaps because of the closeness of people in my life. But on slide 5, when you listed the various ordinance violations, for domestic violence, you said low-level domestic violence. That kind of made me cringe just a little bit. So I'm wondering, when does domestic violence stop being low-level? Tell me what you meant by that.
And I apologize, Councilman Flynn. I never mean to.
I understand that.
What I meant by that is that when someone is arrested or Denver Police Department is called to a scene, it could either be charged in municipal court or state court.
Yes.
If there is injury or bodily injury, that would be a case that would go up to the county court, to district court, right? But if it's a domestic violence, and good to know. I will not use that offensive before, but if there's been no injury, it could be threats or just yelling at each other, or someone threw something and it didn't hit the person. So it's I'd have to think of a better word, but what the ordinance changed a year ago. We have very strong protections. We have the Brady Bill you have to give up all your firearms. There's a mandatory protection order that's put into place. The victim witness advocates are very much involved with the victims that are taking out the charges. They're apprised of every step along the way, so we take these cases extraordinarily seriously. But when I say lower level, it just means that there's not the injury factor, I would say, is probably the best. Would that be the best way of saying it?
Yeah, I would say we have a lot of cases that don't involve any kind of physical injury and could involve very low level, small amounts of property damage, or a person could be charged with domestic violence, but the crime itself is just disturbing the peace because it's just like a loud argument and the officer wasn't sure what else to charge, so they charged disturbing the peace, and it's not any property damage or assault. So we do see relatively lower level domestic violence incidents. It's just that they are involving a romantic partner.
Okay. Thank you. Claire, I understood that you weren't minimizing it at all. You were just trying to draw a distinction.
But language is always important.
I just wanted to get a better understanding.
No, thank you. And if you could connect me with someone from GAIN, that would be greatly appreciated. I'd love to learn more about it. So thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Councilmember Flynn. And since we've spoken about GAIN a few times, I've reached out to Dr. Sanders, and he will be providing briefings to council members. We expect for them to come in November for a presentation before this committee. We're also having Dr. Sanders come to the committee next week to discuss the changes with the Office of Children's Affairs and his, as we are preparing for the conclusion of our budget for 2026. So next week's discussion will be one specific on GAIN because of timing, but the discussion in November will be a comprehensive discussion, including that. And so before that occurs, Colette, I will make sure that that you are have a connection with Dr. Sanders. And I do think it, if your name or the name of your organization was used without collaboration, that is not appropriate. And so we'll have all of those discussions, but know that we've been, I've been leaning in from the moment of the public comment, and we'll provide opportunity publicly for council members to ask questions, and then also have requested briefings for all council members prior to that November meeting on that program and all the other questions council members may have about OSCI. Councilmember Parity, and then Councilmember Cashman.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and thank you for having OMPD in. It's, I think it was belated, and so I'm just really grateful for the presentation because these guys do really good work.
Yes.
I will say super briefly that some of these attorneys I've known for a really long time, and they are really exceptional. So I will double up on Colette's bragging. In fact, there was a known phenomenon in the legal community where suddenly all these really amazing attorneys were going to OMPD, and we were all like, what happened? And it was Colette that happened. And she started just drawing in a lot of talent, and it was like noticed on the outside. So my questions, though, are, first of all, I just... that statistic that I think you guys had on a slide, 40% of municipal cases involve people experiencing homelessness. It's just tragic. Like, that's a sign of systems failure across the board. I don't think that's what any of us want, you know? And so I just hate that this is where we are. And I would be really curious to see that number broken out a little bit by type of offense, because some offenses that people get convicted for are more or less a side effect of being homeless. You know, it's hard to avoid trespass, it's hard to avoid, maybe not unavoidable, but you know, pretty much that's a crime of existing in public. We need to have open container laws, there's a good reason for those, but of course, if you're existing in public and you don't have a private place to go and drink a beverage, you're a lot more likely to be convicted of that and so on. And then there's of course someone experiencing homelessness who's convicted of assault, and like, we would probably want that to be prosecuted regardless, right? So I think I would love to see that broken out a little bit more, because I know they are really high levels of things that we could properly call crimes of poverty, if you're able to do that. And then, and if you know anything off the top of your head, please let me know, but I think that's probably more of an ask for follow-up. And then I wanted to ask a little bit more about some of the statistics about who's being prosecuted for retail theft. We finally got the District 8 and at-large offices, finally got some statistics back from kind of an enforcement push along Quebec Street. And looking at that, if you look at Northfield arrest data, it's a large majority for shoplifting, a large majority female, 24% Black, 38% Hispanic, 62% overall people of color. And then on Quebec Street, 25% Black, 55% people of color. And on Quebec, almost half of the shoplifting arrests from 2025 are from Walmart alone. And so I'm wondering if you all have seen like a, how that shift in shoplifting enforcement has shown up in your offices, I guess, like what the, if you're seeing a lot more retail theft prosecutions, and who it is that gets prosecuted for that kind of thing and what kinds of things they're stealing. You spoke to that a little bit, but I'm just curious about it, given that I just got these stats.
Someone once told me, don't answer a question you don't know the answer to. I'd have to look into it, quite frankly. I mean, we have seen a lot of shoplifting cases, obviously. At the first part of the question, I think if you went around the room and said, like, what's the most ridiculous shoplifting case, like a pickle, a bag of marshmallows, you know, a muffin, a sweatshirt. So we get a lot of those. But the retail theft that you're talking about, I would have to look into the numbers. I don't have that information.
Yeah, thanks for being specific and careful about that. But I am interested in the, like, some sort of like if you've seen a shift in the value of what's being stolen that people are being prosecuted for or anything like that with this kind of enforcement push. So I think those are both follow-up questions. I will keep it to two, even though they're both things that I'm just asking. I'll get back in the queue if I can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Councilmember. And then Councilmember Cashman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Colette, for your presentation. Colette, as my colleague just said, has noticeable respect as an attorney, but the fact most people don't know that she is a Jersey girl. Brings it all to a high.
I know. Thank you.
I didn't want that to.
I appreciate it.
I am so tired of Denver and Colorado talking about how important our children are, and doing nothing to back that up. Up until is it 2 years ago now?
About July 2014.
Yeah.
2024.
24.
Thank
right.
you.
That council finally passed a law, before which kids with no dough would go into court by themselves. Their parents couldn't go with them. The OMPD was not tasked with defending them. So we would send our kids, children, before a prosecutor who would offer them a deal and smile at them and tell them it was a great idea for them, and they would sign. So it is great, obviously, that we've made that leap. I am a little concerned when I hear of just the lack of collaboration between CAO and OMPD, and I'm not quite sure how diversion at this point fits into the mix, but when the Councilwoman Gonzalez Gutierrez and I were working with OMPD and all of the partners, it really became a kumbaya moment where everybody realized the importance of what they're trying to get done. And I think it's really critical that especially the CAO takes a more focused view on the importance of consistency and partnership in this. And I just couldn't be more, and there may be a question coming, there may just be a comment. The question I was going to ask that actually came, one of my aides texted me with, was did the closure of the aid center affect you?
And 100%.
You know, I hear from the administration these reasons why it's not gonna be a big deal, and every advocate for the unhoused community, for people coming out of the justice system, feel the exact opposite. Couldn't be a better location on planet Earth to serve that purpose for the Denver community. So, Lord, we need to get serious about this as a community. You know, we're in the midst of our budget discussions, and closing the aid center was part of the budget discussions. And it is a challenging time. I'd like to make your work easier. I'd like to make the work of our police department easier.
Yeah.
And we just don't seem to get how to do that. So I will just double everyone's compliments for the work you all do. You've got an amazing team. Keep up the good work. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Councilmember Cashman, and thank you and Councilmember Gonzalez Gutierrez on that good work. I think that was important. I had no idea, no clue that kids would walk into court without representation. I mean, it's scary itself walking into court, walking into this building and seeing kind of dealing with their courtrooms, but to have a child walking in and not have representation. So at the basis, Councilmember Cashman, of caring for our children, the idea that it took so long for that to actually even happen, it's really your due diligence and that of Councilwoman Gonzalez Gutierrez. So thank you both and his council for passing this. And so greatly appreciated and greatly needed. And I'll say, Collad and team, I visited the aid center as frequently as I can, even prior to, well, since I've been a city council member, and the ways in which the aid center provided support for communities is unique. It is a great concern that that's no longer there. I remember my first year, I think 12 judges sent me a letter stating the importance of keeping the aid center, and I've kept those letters from them, and why they so desperately wanted for the aid center to continue to be funded. And so we're in a budget discussions, and so we're going to continue looking at where our priorities are at and what can be done. And so I have, let me do, I had two questions and I just got lost in that. The first question, my ask would be for your office, as we're looking at the work that you do and the supports that you provide to communities, especially communities that are unhoused, what's the coordinated process even beyond Denver? Now, you're stretched. I know you barely got time to deal with the stuff you're dealing with, but I'm curious, is there a space and place where public defenders gather, meet, speak on regional solutions for what we're seeing? Because obviously, the folks who are unhoused aren't simply, they could care less what the boundary of Denver is and Adams and Jeffco, et cetera. Is there a forum, a space, a place in which the absolutely clear, amazing work that you're doing is communicated broadly, maybe with a regional lens?
We have tried now in the last year to have more coordination with municipal defenders statewide, which means there's only two municipal public defenders in the state of Colorado, us and Aurora.
Oh, okay.
We have a training coming up November 3rd, which is open to all lawyers that represent people in municipal court. So at these conferences, we share with our colleagues some of the work that we're doing, some of the issues that we're facing in Denver, but we are always able to, my greatest goal in life would be that this model would go flourish in the state of Colorado and go elsewhere. I think we are one of the, I don't know of another municipal public defender's office that is run like this holistically. So I would share it with anyone that we could, but we are trying to be more coordinated.
And my second question, and I know Councilmember Torres put you in the queue, and then I believe Councilmember Perry was back in the queue. We've had some changes with service providers for our shelter programs. I think Public Alchemy, I think is, let me see if I say the name correctly.
Urban
Alchemy is a new organization. Obviously, Bayard is providing support as well. I'm curious, have you had an introduction with those organizations? And if not, we maybe could try to facilitate that. Obviously, as they're providing support on the 48th Street corridor, and as well as some of the other former Salvation Army sites, it may be of support to your team. So curious if you've had an introduction to them, and if not,
we have not.
Okay.
Sir.
So our team will make sure that those introductions occur. We're providing that support so that any impacts at those sites aren't just directly there aren't alternatives or options provided that because those service providers have no idea what your office does. So we'll make sure we do that connection and without trying to burden you with extra work.
Thank you.
All right. Councilmember Torres and Councilmember Parody.
Thank you so much. Just thinking on the aid center conversation, it's only a few years old. Mm-hmm. And so what
What was utilized before 2022 when that was established? And was it established for the purpose that you benefited from, you know, at, towards before its closure?
I'm going to put this to Ari because he, thank sure. you, Councilman Thomas, because he was working with LEED and at the very beginning, so.
Yeah, thank you for that question. I think prior to the AIDS Center, you know, all of the resources that the AIDS Center was providing existed before the AIDS Center existed. What the AIDS Center did is they brought them all into one location, sort of a one-stop shop. And so we had these programs, Outreach Court, the LEED program, the wellness program, that could access those resources, but they had to go and find them. Mm-hmm. What the AIDS Center did is it brought all those resources into one place, and then it started being able to pull in other resources that weren't so readily available. You know, the DMV would come to the AIDS Center periodically to help people get their ID or driver's license, things like that. And so it really became sort of a one-stop shop where people didn't have to just, it made those resources so much more accessible because they were right there. And then on top of that, it added the things that Colette talked about, the lockers for people to store their belongings, kennels for them to keep their animals while they went to their court dates, things like that.
SSI checks.
What's that?
Our Social Security and SSDI checks were sent to the AIDS Center for our clients.
People could receive their mail there.
And if you don't, if you miss two, you lose your benefits.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was a huge thing for our clients, too.
Yeah. Okay. Super helpful in understanding that. The other thing that I'm curious about, because I was in on the city side in Human Rights and Community Partnerships 2017 when we changed the municipal sentencing structure back then, it definitely sounds like it's due for that kind of whole cloth review. And just with a new city attorney on board, hopefully she can see the value in doing that. It was done relatively quickly in 2017, and we were really only responding to the 365 kind of pressure date, right? And so other things I think coming to light, particularly the example you gave of a dog bite being criminal and should be civil, that probably feels like an overall process that needs to be done by almost like a task force or a team to review our current municipal sentencing structure. We've done it before, we can do it again. So just hopeful that that might be something that could be teed up.
Thank you very much, Councilwoman. And we are very excited to say that we would jump on that. Rachel's been looking at the ordinance. If you read the ordinance sometimes, you'd be shocked at some of the...
Totally. Some of these things have been written in a different era almost, right?
You tear a page out of a public library book. But the cases that we see on a regular basis, we really need to look at the sentencing structure. So we are ready to go.
Yeah. I know I do. We'll see either commentary on our social media posts when we talk about criminal justice reform or in person from constituents who really still feel that penalty or threat of penalty is the change that's needed to change behavior or culture patterns or whatever they might see. And I think it is that like top down, just put them in jail for 90 days and that'll solve their substance use or, right, all of these things. And especially with the cost that you brought there of, what was it, 197 a day jail bed-ish?
It's probably more now. That was a couple years
ago. I wouldn't be surprised. It's double what it costs to house someone in a micro community.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Like there are things like that where... we talk about it in really theoretical terms mm-hmm. about what changes individual patterns of behavior and what are the better options. But it's why we, as a city many years ago, did like the social impact bond philosophy that investing early actually saves money at the end. And I think we've just, it's just kind of branched off quite a bit from why did we consider that as a core philosophy in the city in the first place? Because it actually is better. But, you know, I just thank you for continuing to bring these things to light and just hope I can be helpful and council continues to be helpful in some of the solutions.
I would thank you so much. I've said this so many times in so many meetings, we'd like a seat at the table. We intimately know what goes on in municipal court. Yeah. I didn't know about a lot of these things that happened, and it was a shock to hear about, you know, budget, aid center, cuts to, you know, programs and stuff. And I wish that someone had picked up the phone or asked me to come to the table or someone, because we really have a lot of institutional knowledge about what's going on the ground. So anytime we can help, we would love to be there.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Councilmember Torres. And Councilmember Perry.
Yeah, so I wanted to take a step back, actually, to the Quebec Task Force, because I realized when I was asking about the statistics, I know there's been a task force convened to address an uptick in shoplifting on the Quebec corridor, and there were conversations about adding the Public Defender's Office to that. Have you all been added to that task force?
No.
Okay. Have you been engaged about it or asked about it or given information
about
it?
Brief conversations. I know that Mr. Hoffman and I, we've talked about it, but yeah.
Okay.
So I'm aware of it. But.
Okay. Yeah, I continue to think that it would make a lot of sense for you all to have a seat on that, obviously, because people get arrested, they show up in your offices, right? So it just seems like if there's a goal towards some genuine prevention that you would be a good partner. So I'll, I guess, continue to advocate for that. To be honest, I'm surprised that change didn't occur. So I apologize that I was asking kind of out of context questions then about statistics from that. And then can you return to the animal offenses topic that you raised at the beginning and tell us a little bit more about, like, what is in our code, what people get prosecuted for, and what, if any, changes you might recommend to that? We've talked about it a little, but it's been a while, so.
A lot of our, we have a pretty steady flow of clients that are charged criminally for things like their dog is off the leash, particularly if some kind of animal bite occurs. Their dog bites another dog, their dog bites a person because they were off a leash. And those are criminal offenses, and people are facing potential jail time for things like that.
I guess I would just say there are a variety, I would say, of very regulatory-feeling animal offenses that are crimes in the city of Denver, punishable by up to 300 days of jail. That would include having your dog off leash, not getting a rabies violation, a vaccination, not spaying or neutering your dog, any amount of neglect of an animal, even if it's a grooming service that you can't afford to pay for. That's a crime in the city of Denver, punished by jail. So there's, I think, a range of things that could be. Some of them could have lower penalties. Some of them could be decriminalized. I know frequently when these cases go to a jury trial, the juries are surprised that they're having a criminal jury trial about something like, was the dog on or off leash and did you get your rabies vaccination? And they're saying it's not that I don't think it's important to enforce these things. It just feels like this is more like a regulatory situation of how do we do animal control in the city versus throwing people in jail.
Okay. There's also this like weird kind of strict liability. So your friend takes your dog, two dogs out for a walk. You're not anywhere near and the dogs bite someone. The owner gets charged. So they have no idea of any of this happening. May not have even said, take my dog for a walk. So the way that the ordinances are written, is it really needs to be revised.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you for that. And I know we have some like material on that from your office that, I mean, there are, I think, a lot of things about our criminal code that need to be revised, and I think everybody here has already been briefed on some of the sentencing changes that a few council members are working on and co-sponsoring, but that is also high on my personal mental list, so thanks for bringing it back up. Okay, I wanted to also go back to the GAIN program and just ask, I would love for the Public Defender's Office to get briefed on this and be able to kind of dig in on it. Councilmember Flynn, for what it's worth, I remember reading the book that David Kennedy, who came up with Operation Ceasefire, wrote a long time ago, and it was sort of touted at the time as a really promising approach, and it has gone well in some cities. It has gone really badly in a few places like Baltimore, and I think one of the things that's been a hinge point for success or failure has been community buy-in. So I'm worried that we're not getting off on a great foot with that, and that's kind of the secret sauce. So I just would ask council members, I think we all should be getting briefed. I'm glad they're coming to committee. And I hope that we will all ask some pretty pointed questions about the community engagement piece. I also, what community groups had presented to them was that there were 3,500 youth already on the list. And
that those were definitely not all kids who had been convicted of a crime or been a victim of gun crime, because there aren't that many kids that are a victim of gun crime at a given time. So there's a disconnect there too. And I just think we need to keep doing what we're doing, which is sort of being investigative and pushing on it. Cause I think it's one of those devils in the details kind of things. So we don't end up on the list of cities where it didn't go well, and end up on the list of cities where, you know, something positive happened. So, that is more of a comment, but since we brought it up, do you mind if I ask one more question, or are other people back in queue?
No, I think you're fine.
Okay,
you're fine.
I don't want to filibuster, but yeah, we have time. So, sorry, let me scroll up here and find my notes. I wanted to ask about, I think, are going to be seeing a renewal of the Axon contract soon. And I just got wind that there's been a change in Axon access for your office. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Starting in June of 2019, we had a contract with Axon, and we were getting Axon access. We got licenses so that when the DPD would send the body-worn camera discovery to the city attorney's office, the city attorney's office would send us the link on that case to Axon, and then a separate link to upload the files. Is that right? I'm going to say this correctly.
So, yeah. So, when we originally had a contract with Axon, the city attorney would share the case with us. And that would send our office a link. That link would enable us to full access to the case file in Axon. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of functionality within Axon that we would then have access to along with the city attorney. So, for example, let's say you have a case where there's multiple body-worn cameras within Axon that would enable us to sync those videos together and watch multiple videos that are synced in time together. It would give us GPS information for the body cam as the video is playing and showing us the movement of the body cam. It would provide us a table of contents showing us who had uploaded the body cam, how long the videos were, a lot of sort of metadata related to the videos. In July of 2024, so we would get that first link where the case file is shared with us. That would enable us to go in, select which videos we wanted to download, which is typically all of them. We would then get a second link from Axon that would initiate the download. In July of 2024, the city attorney's office changed the way they were providing that to us. They stopped sharing the case file with us. All we were receiving was a link to download the videos out of Axon. We no longer have, and since then, we do not have access to the case file in Axon. So if we were to even log into Axon today and search for a current case file, we would not get any result. We cannot even see the case in Axon. So we no longer have access to any of the functionality of Axon, despite the fact that we still have a contract with Axon and are still paying Axon for access to that. We don't have that access anymore.
I would add that a lot of this came also further to light because we were trying to renegotiate our contract with Axon. And the representative gave us a beautiful demonstration about all of the, you know, generation 3, 4, which is now DPD is on generation 4, what the capabilities are, what is all you know, even you press a button, you get the transcription. We have a lot of Spanish to English. It'd be fantastic. So I was very excited about it. But then when I started speaking to the lawyers and went to Ari, it's like, we can't even do that because we don't have Axon access anymore. I met with Axon. He was the rep was very surprised that we didn't have the same Axon access. I met with Commander Barnes. He came to our office last week, and he was very surprised that we didn't have the same access. It's really an issue because we're getting the discovery in a different way than DPD has it and the city attorney's office has it. So for 5 years we had full access, and then it was just cut off without notice. So I've sent out an email yesterday to have a stakeholder meeting with, and you know, Commander Barnes is willing to participate in Axon. So I sent out the email to the city attorney's office as well, so that we can all sit at the same table and have a meeting about having that access brought back to us. I think it makes it much easier for everyone. For the city attorney's office, they don't have to download all the body warrants and then upload it into evidence.com, and then we don't have to download it all and keep track of it. There's a lot of multiple body warrants keep coming into our office because of the way it's given to us. I think the city attorney's office would benefit, and we certainly would benefit from the ease of being able to access Axon.
Okay, thank you for that and for making us aware of it.
Yeah.
That's all I wanted to ask about, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Councilmember Parody. Thank you, Colette, and your team for all the work that you do. A lot was brought up today, and know that whether there was a direct response or not, there'll be a follow-up on each of those items that you and your team has brought forward to this committee. I want to thank each of you in the audience as well for all of the work that you do and the ways that you serve our communities, and look forward to on a more robust cadence, Colette, to have your team come before this committee to and through next year. Thank you all. And with that, we have four items in consent. Since they've not been pulled off, this meeting's adjourned. Thanks, everyone.